Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ta for Ta, Women, Success, China, is powered by the Seneca Network. We are a biweekly podcast focused on capturing the lives of women in and from Greater China at the top of their professional game. I'm your host, Juliana Batista. Many thanks to the entire team at SUP China, including co-producer Kaiser Kuo, Jason McRonald for editing, and Jamie Lay for marketing. Speaking of, help us out and take a few minutes to fill out our brief listener survey, the link to which can be found in the show description. Your responses are appreciated and help us create better content for you. This week, we are joined by Jenny Dorsey, professional chef and creative, with a mission to use culinary arts as a platform to evoke introspection, empathy, and real emotion. What I really appreciated about her, and I couldn't quite pinpoint until listening back on the episode, was her tenacity. You'll hear throughout our conversation about moments where she was so far outside her realm, but persists. Guided by this powerful drive, and also wanting to shape the narrative and being bold in doing so. I found this quite inspiring, and I think you will too. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Ta for Ta, Woman Success China. We are really excited today. We're joined by Jenny Dorsey. She is a professional chef and founder of Studio Tao, and we'll learn more about her various career endeavors that we are entering right now. So really excited to have you on the show, Jenny.
Thanks for having me.
And I think, you know, a great place to start, and we usually start at this spot, is, you know, just telling listeners a bit about yourself, almost a highlights reel of your career. Kind of, can you paint in some broad brushstrokes, you know, your career trajectory and, you know, who you are?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a career changer into the food world. I actually started my career after college as a management consultant within the fashion and luxury goods space at Accenture. I moved to New York. I went to school in Seattle, so moved to the big city in hopes of pursuing this like fashion career that I thought I always wanted, and pretty quickly realized that I liked, you know, the glamour of having this title or, you know, being able to be next to these designers and buy clothes. But I really had this huge hole in my heart on, like, I didn't like what I was doing. I wasn't passionate about career. I didn't really like the people I was working with. And I just didn't really know what to do. So I was really depressed. And I honestly, like, I went through so many things trying to fix it. I tried to buy a lot of stuff. I was binge eating for a while and went to like therapy for that. It was like a whole thing. And finally, I came to this conclusion that I just needed a break. I didn't actually want to take the big leap of faith and go pivot my career. So instead, I really took like a pretty cowardly approach in retrospect and deferred having to deal with it by applying to business school. So I got into Columbia Business School early decision, which meant I had about 9 months before I actually started work, started going to school. So instead of, usually people just continue working during that time, I decided to quit my job and go to culinary school. And I never thought that culinary school would, you know, pivot into a career. Honestly, I saw it as a, like a creative sabbatical before I would go back to, you know, business school and go work in consulting again and make tons of money and whatever. And I, in culinary school, I just really fell in love with the people that I was with. I was attending an evening class, so it was mostly other career changers as well. I realized so much about myself, mostly that, you know, I had really put a lot of emphasis on, you know, surrounding myself with people who were very similar to me, very ambitious, which is great, but also I think many times put a lot of importance on the wrong things and really cared too much about job titles and success and money. And culinary school and the people there helped teach me, I think, a more deep level of just appreciating myself and kind of tapping into what I truly enjoyed. So I still went back to school at business school, but after a semester realized it was just not the right fit for me. So ended up leaving early and going just to figure out who I was. And that was a really scary time because A, I had a lot of outstanding debt, but also I just genuinely didn't know what I wanted to do in the food industry besides that I wanted to be in that industry. I didn't want to work in restaurants for the rest of my life. That's a really, really hard career and lifestyle, and it wasn't quite what I enjoyed either. I kind of bounced around and did all these different internships. It was fun in its own way. I was a barista. I was a door-to-door juice salesperson. In this like weird twist of fate, I was like literally going door to door to some of like the most biggest like venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, trying to sell them green juice, and got access to some of these names. Like I would tell my husband, like, "Oh, I like met blah and blah today, trying to sell him green juice," and he's like, "Wait, that guy is like worth billions of dollars." So there was some funny things that happened during that time. Worked in PR a little bit. Ended up at a job in food and beverage R&D at a place called Le Pain Quotidien, which is a French boulangerie or French Belgian boulangerie. They're a chain in the US, and they also own the stores in the UK and France. And we have franchises everywhere as well. So I was doing menu R&D for all our corporate owned stores, and very quickly realized like I really enjoyed that kind of work. I just didn't happen to like the company very much. So branched out on my own, started kind of doing my own culinary consulting, mostly working with restaurants. Also during all the internships that I had done, had picked up some styling skills. So I was started to do some food styling, some food photography, and slowly was able to build my client base where I was consulting essentially full time. During that time, it was also very satisfying to consult and, you know, be able to run my own business, but I wasn't ultimately being creative for the things that I wanted to be creative about. I was, you know, making food that other people requested, or making, you know, a lot of times for restaurants, you make a menu, but it needs to be engineered so that it's the right cost, or it looks a certain way, or it hits certain flavor profiles for their target audience. So it wasn't just me experimenting willy-nilly for myself. So as a creative outlet, my husband and I created this supper club called Wednesdays. And at the time, it was just a way to get our friends together. I would make the food, and he's a mixologist, so he would make the drinks. And it was supposed to be this like casual, how do we get people to engage on a deeper level, talk about things that were, you know, not just work or the subway or the weather, but, you know, get into nitty gritty things while being able to also, you know, have us experiment and have fun. And by like the first or second dinner, we had these strangers showing up, friends of friends, people we didn't know, like literally just random people, and this used to be our apartment. So I think pretty quickly we realized that there was something here that we wanted to tap into, and slowly that grew into this pop-up dinner series that we ran for a few years. That got more press and more popular, which was really great. We went to San Francisco and got press there, etc. But slowly I also realized that it had, you know, it was kind of a double-edged sword. Well, we had gone so popular that coming to our dinners became sceney, and it no longer became about emotional connection. It no longer became about really getting to know other people. And it also really didn't have like the impact that I wanted. There were bigger social issues that I wanted to talk about that I think, you know, at the beginning I was too scared to, but then towards the end I felt like I had no way to because of the confines of, you know, just the structure we had built ourselves. Mm-hmm. So as a way to get back to what I really cared about, I remember we had a pop-up at the beginning of 2018 and I was like, no more. Like, I can't, this is not right. It's not what I want to do. I don't know what it is. I just kind of shut down and didn't do anything for 6 months. Or I was working, but I wasn't doing any pop-ups. And we rebranded it during that time, turned into a nonprofit. And now Studio Tao is a community organization. We're a nonprofit. And we do content and we do live experiences that specifically have to do with food, art, and social impact. So every dinner that we do is very themed. We have one that's about the Asian American experience, one that's about cognitive dissonance, and one that's about the invisibility of female pain. So it's very, it's overt what we're talking about. There's nobody comes and is, I mean, I want them to have a good time, but no one's just having a good time to have a good time. So that has felt so much better and just really helped like clear up the direction of where my life was headed.
Yeah. And I think you give a really overarching view, I think, with detail. So we're all kind of teased about, you know, where we can take this interview and, you know, what we can talk about. And I think I actually really want to backtrack a bit with you and just go back, because I think you point out that this was a really key changing point for you in your career, as you talked about, you know, leaving your MBA for culinary school. And you said it was a really vulnerable moment. Would you say that's like one of the most vulnerable moments in your career? Like, what was going through your mind at the time? I think it's so much easier with hindsight 2020 to say, you know, that was the right choice. But I just kind of want to get a little bit more in the mind space, because it seems like that was such a pivotal moment for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny, when I look back on it, I knew the whole first semester I was not having a good time. Besides, I mean, I met my husband at business school, so I guess I was having a good time with that. But like, I was not invested with the course curriculum, because I had also gone to business school undergrad. So I guess, sorry, everyone who might be listening who's interested in going to business school, but there is a lot of repeat curriculum in the first, especially the first year, if you have a business background. So I was not engaged. I just didn't want to be there. And I think the big thing was, I just didn't like a lot of the people I was with. And not because they're bad people or anything, but our interests just weren't aligned anymore. Again, as I said, I used to really be surrounded by people who are like, yeah, you want to make the most money, you want to get that big bonus, you want to have that big promotion, and you want to say you work at McKinsey, like all of that stuff. And that was really where I put, you know, the whole emphasis in my life. And after culinary school, I didn't really feel that way anymore. But when I went back into Columbia, that was again what people were kind of jostling about at networking, like, oh, I came from Bain and I work at Goldman. And I couldn't connect with these people. And I was just tired of it. This all manifested in me really just not being present. I think I literally wasn't on campus very frequently, but also I had terrible grades. So really at the end of the semester, I got called into the dean's office and was like, you have very bad grades. And like, Columbia's a pass-fail system. Most of the MBA organizations are now, but like, if you fail enough classes, obviously you still get in trouble. Or if your so many classes are at the brink of failing, you know, then you kind of obviously get called basically into detention. And I remember her saying, like, you know, most people who have as bad grades as you do, it's because they don't have any business background. So they're really struggling to understand like microeconomics. But that's clearly not the case, because you already took microeconomics in undergrad and got a 4.0. So you just aren't applying yourself. So like, what's going on? And I obviously argued with her, and I was like, no, that's not true. You know, I just had a bad semester. I had all sorts of excuses, but she was right. She was quite right. And she told me that she felt I needed to take some time off. I then again argued with her, and she told me that, you know what, they're not going to let me come back for the next semester. I should take at least 6 months off, and then I could come back in the summertime. So essentially I had at least 6 months off regardless. And she was like, keep in touch. You're basically an open, you can come back anytime, just not next semester. Had like this total meltdown, and I was like, oh my God, my life is over. But honestly, it was a blessing in disguise, even though it felt a little bit at the time that it was forced on me. I had to go and find something else to do with my life. And what better thing to do, I suppose, is try out the career that I kind of wanted, but was too afraid to actually pursue. Now I kind of had that safety net there of going back to school if I wanted to. But once I started in the food world, it became pretty clear there was no point in going back to school.
Yeah, that's interesting. How you said almost like this decision was forced upon you. It seems like from a lot of the steps that you've taken in your career that, you know, there's this power for you in being able to create something from the ground up and really be able to call the shots. Was that hard at the time to have someone say, you know, this is something that, you know, you don't have full autonomy over?
Absolutely. I'm an only child, and sometimes my friend will tell me that I act like an only child. I'm definitely used to getting my way or arguing my way to get what I want. And it felt I was like trying every, you know, every approach with my dean. I was crying and then I was like yelling and then I was like sad. And she was just like, no, you just can't just take some time off. Yeah.
So I think, you know, you made this big change. And then did you create almost a plan for what you wanted to do next? Did you know, okay, I'm going to go work, try to work in some top level Michelin star restaurants, get better grasp of the culinary world after? Is that a part of the program that you normally had to take? You know, I just want to like understand a bit more about kind of how you hack your way to success in this world, because you know, it's fascinating, and it probably was really daunting when you first kind of left the MBA track to go do something else.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a great sense of what I was going to do. I decided to start a little blog for myself to at least track what I was doing every day so I didn't fall into a pit of despair, which I fell into for a few weeks for sure. But as part of my culinary school, you do have to complete something called an externship, which is just an internship. I'm not actually sure why it's called an externship, but you go work at a restaurant for a set number of hours to complete it, and that way you get in the field training. So I knew I always wanted to work in a Michelin-starred restaurant, but it's somewhat difficult to land an externship at one of the big places right off the bat. And if you are one of the lucky ones, you know, rumor has it, I can't confirm because I've only worked in those kitchens as a slightly more experienced cook, is that they're really mean to the externs and they'll call you up at like 2 a.m. and make you just work for no reason. So I didn't really want to do that. So I ended up, you know, a couple steps down, I worked at an upscale place in West Village called Market Table, which is like a really lovely new American restaurant. And really just enjoyed the chef there. I later on like learned more about his life, and he also had this very interesting career into the food world. He used to do something completely different, and he ended up being a reservationist at 11 Madison Park, and then went back to school for food, and then ended up being a chef and worked in all these different types of places, etc. And I just remember him saying like, you know, I don't see you working in restaurants forever. I really think that you're meant to go and just try out all these different things. I could really see you doing more food media things. Maybe you would like make the food on Oprah. I don't remember what exactly he referenced, but he was such a great boss and like encouraged me to go try some other things, because so many other restaurants will tell their externs just stay here and work forever and be a robot. So that like really helped propel me to go just say like, hey, this is a time where I'm not making any money anyway. I have a little bit of savings. Like if I can get as much experience as I can under my belt, at least I can figure out what I do or don't like. And at the beginning was mostly, I don't like this, I don't like this, I don't like this, or I don't really like this part, but I like this other aspect of it. I really like the teamwork in a restaurant, but I don't like the hours, or I don't like how stressful it can be, etc. It was just figuring out all of those balances for myself. No job is ever going to be perfect, but I think finding my boundaries of like, this is just, I can't sign up for, like, I can't accept this lifestyle, or I can't accept this as long as it offers me these other feelings or these other, you know, sense of stability or whatnot. So I spent like a good year just really doing that, and I many times felt pretty aimless during that time because I was just jumping from job to job. But again, in hindsight, it was really invaluable experience just to learn that from the get-go instead of, you know, signing on for a full-time job and realizing I didn't like it 3 months in.
Yeah. And it also seems like you are someone that's willing to kind of take the jump on things and like have the grit to do it. I'm getting this sense from you. I mean, even from the way that, you know, we had some initial, you know, conversations and back and forth. It seems like you're going to take that jump. And I wanted to know, you know, was the start of Wednesdays kind of a jump moment, or was it, you know, again, something that was thought over, calculated over a long period of time?
No, I mean, you're definitely right in that I'm definitely one to kind of throw myself in things, because I do now feel you have to at least try, because I don't ever want to wake up and feel really sad or feel like I didn't even explore what was possible. That is more daunting to me than going out and really failing. I failed so many times. I feel you can really build up a resistance to failing or be a more acceptance to failing. So for Wednesdays, which actually used to be called, I forgot it's Wednesday, but we shortened it a little bit. It's kind of a long title. I remember I was talking to my then boyfriend, now husband, about how we never got to know anybody at school. He was still in school at the time. All I wanted to do was just have a deeper conversation with these people. I remember someone had was talking about their relationship with their grandmother, and then somebody else joined our table, and immediately the conversation turned to work. And I just wanted to build a table where people could actually be themselves. So we threw up a website in like a week and then just invited a couple random people at a time. And I put together this very complicated menu. And in hindsight, it was too complicated for our first meal. And the first meal was like a total mess. I mean, everything came out in the wrong order. We had these like really bright lights because I like white light in our apartment. And everybody was like just like sitting under like fluorescent light, essentially. Our dog was there eating people's food. Like, we lived in this tiny one bedroom in New York. And honestly, for the two of us, it was a decent size, but with like 8 people in the room, everybody was so cramped, and like people were like sweating. So yeah, there it could have been better, but honestly, like, I had such a good time. You know, there's like all the things that you've done wrong, but then you grasp onto the few things that just kind of tell you to keep going. And immediately we knew that we wanted to at least just keep trying this out to see where it went, because it was like very addicting. It was so exciting to, you know, be able to share something of yours with other people. And I think we did that for like 3 months before we decided to really take a jump and do a 100 person event, even though the biggest event we'd ever done was 10 people. It was a huge disaster. Again, we had rented this venue that was way too expensive. We actually rented really nice benches and chairs and tables that were super heavy, so it was really hard to move them in and out. We rented like all these plateware that was like impossible to wash, and glassware, and we put stickers on them. So I remember like at 2 a.m. I was like peeling stickers off this mason jar. My thumb is like, you're bleeding. We rented a tree. Trees are apparently very expensive to rent, in case anybody's wondering. And they sent the wrong size tree, so then it was too small, and then it was too tall. And like, we got this artificial turf. I mean, it was a whole thing. So anyway, we learned a lot from that. And that was kind of the moment where the two of us realized, like, we either gotta do it or we stop, because this was insane. Like, either we do this again and we do it better, or we really stop because we lost so much money and this is like a hot mess. So yeah, I think that's been the theme of just the food industry or the food career that I've had, is just going for it and trying it out.
And you actually brought up this point to me too, that, you know, it's a nebulous concept, the idea of engaging people over food and drink. And I was kind of hoping that you could explain that a bit more. And you make this point that it's difficult to operate a nonprofit around this nebulous idea, and maybe how that's evolved over time, or why you think it's such a nebulous concept.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, or at least I would say most people, have feelings about food and drink as, you know, this time of gathering, it feels good, et cetera, or it's supposed to feel good. And because of that, everybody has this like PR statement of like, you know, food and drink that, you know, brings us to the table. But when we actually get to the table, it's not that like something magically happens and we all become friends and we share these vulnerabilities. All of that also has to be an orchestrated event. And I think a lot of people get to everyone is now literally physically at the table, but then we haven't taken that next step. Because especially as adults, you know, we're nervous about being vulnerable in front of strangers. I don't want to talk about my dog dying or my grandpa passing in front of these people I've never met, especially if I don't feel like they're going to respond in the same way to me, or I don't have a structure in place to start talking about these things. There's so much responsibility that the host really needs to bear for people to connect deeply with food or without food, but I mean, in this case, with food. And I think a lot of times, even at the beginning, we didn't realize that. And for a lot of other operators that I see in the food business, I don't think they really it's not that they don't care, but it's maybe they don't have the time, or it's just so much work that it's so much of a burden in addition to worrying about rent, worrying about whatever else, you know, other business operations that they have to worry about. Having people connect really is like a conscientious effort. So I think during the first 2 years, all we were learning is how do we get people to even open up, because we can't force them into anything. Nobody likes those icebreakers. Nobody wants to go around the table and introduce themselves, but people desperately want to talk to each other. People want to be heard. They want to feel like they're not alone. So what are the things that we can put in a little toolkit and offer them at the, you know, at the table, like physically or metaphorically, so that they're able to open up. And we tried things that worked and some things that didn't. But one of the things that I remember that I always really liked is instead of giving people named cards, right, you usually see named cards at tables, we would ask them a question in advance. And it would be a pretty probing question. So for example, one of the questions we used was, what is your biggest failure and how has that shaped you? And that we would ask everyone the same question. It was part of the ticket checkout. So you had to answer the question to get the ticket. If your answer was bad, or like you typed in like not applicable, we would just refund you your ticket. So there was a self-selecting process. It's really important to guard the people who do end up coming, because you only have one, if you have one bad apple at the table, they ruin the experience for everyone. And I think that's a luxury too. At the beginning, we couldn't just turn people away, but soon when we were selling out, we could care more about curating the guest list. So once you have people bought in, they answered the questions, people would write these little essays on their name cards, and we would use their answers as name cards. So instead of reading, you know, Rob, like there was still a name on it, so you could find your seat, but instead of just Rob, it'd be Rob and then Rob's biggest failure. And you walk around the whole table, we would encourage everyone to make sure to read everyone's answers before they sat down. And all of a sudden, you know way more about these 9 people next to you than you would have probably learned in like months of conversation with them. And I think that just really sets the stage of like, we're serious about what we do. If we also would stand up there and share our failures, be vulnerable. And it's about like, I'm willing to do this. I hope that you are too. And I think that's like a big lead by example moment that I learned along the way. Now that we're doing more focused thematic dinners, for example, for Asian and America, we send out lists of questions that we help like kind of push people to talk about during the experience. And every single one of the courses is actually mapped to a different topic. So for example, one of the courses talks about the model minority myth, and literally like you are going to talk about that. It's integrate into the food, which we can talk about later. It's integrated into the virtual reality experience, which we can also talk about later. Like you can't take off your headset and start talking about the weather. It just like would feel very strange. So you are suddenly just getting into it with these 4 to 6 people at your table. We also reduced the table size because we felt that worked better. Just like little things like that has been really about priming people and making sure that they kind of commit to it. And then also curating the right audience so that they know what they're signing up for, and like when they show up, they are ready to go.
Yeah, I was going to say it's probably this balance or chicken and egg of the type of people that would be drawn to these food and drink experiences would be open to the experience, but also getting people in the right space, the right mental space, the right emotional space to actually experience the food and drink experiences. So that makes a lot of sense.
A big part of it is also like literally where the thing is held. Many times, you know, especially when you're a new pop-up, you're like just trying to find space anywhere at someone's house and whatever, at a restaurant that's closed, a coffee shop. And we learned like how the facade of the place looks really does change how you feel. And so for example, Asian in America, when we host our own, we always host them with like a museum, so that when people go to museums or art galleries or, you know, kind of that, they're in the mindset to learn, they're in the mindset to listen, they're in the mindset to observe, like they're assuming that there's going to be something educational, intellectual there, because that's what museums are, you know, versus if we held it at an empty club, it would be a very different experience, which we have also done for a separate experience that had involved dance, which I think made a lot more sense in that space. It was like this dungeonous, dark space, and it was about going into the depths of ourselves. So I think also finding like the right spatial map for what your dinner looks like is really important.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, you just teased Asian in America. I would love if you could tell listeners a bit more about the concept. I think, you know, of your work, it really is in line with the types of content we cover at SubChina, and just kind of learning a bit more about, you know, the concept in general. And then I'd love to dive into maybe like a specific course from that menu, from that experience, and understand, you know, how you go about creating the discrete elements that make up the experience.
Yeah, of course. So Asian in America is a exhibition and dinner experience that talks about the Asian American identity through food and drink, virtual reality, and poetry. There's six courses of food and three courses of cocktails, and each of them talk about a different topic within the Asian American narrative. So for example, one of the courses of food is the model minority myth. One of the other courses of food is about the white male savior complex. One of them is about the interchangeable Asian. One of the cocktail courses is called revisionist history, and it talks about how there's a certain liquor that called Batavia Rack that is from Indonesia, but because they were colonized by the Netherlands, they don't actually even sell it through. It's all through the Netherlands now, and how we understand that liquor is very much through a colonial mindset. So every single one of these courses is meant to spur conversation at the table. We usually see people in groups of 4 to 6, and we host dinners usually under 40 people. So it is a relatively intimate, small event. We've been touring this series from New York to all the way to Honolulu since 2018. And for the virtual reality and the poetry component, the courses alternate between having a VR accompaniment and a poetry accompaniment. So for example, the model minority course is accompanied with VR, and you actually go into a VR headset and you're watching a brushstroke by brushstroke recreation of the dish that you're about to eat. And there's audio narration from myself explaining what the symbolism is behind each of the ingredients, as well as the plating, as well as the cooking techniques, and you know why I chose that, what that means. And it's like interwoven with a bit of personal narrative of why it's important to me. For the poetry, it's similar, it's just not quite as visual. It's a poem that I've written about that course. So one of the poetry courses, for example, is about stereotypes that Asian communities have on each other. There's a lot of colorism in the Asian community, especially. So there's touches upon that. We usually, as I mentioned, work with museums, but we've also been to different film festivals and kind of like different, interestingly, applicable, I guess, restaurants and such. So hopefully we'll be able to bring it back at some point again this year. We did one for Lunar New Year, and that's the last event we've done so far because of COVID.
I'd love to understand a bit more, you know, how did you decide to integrate VR into the experiences, and how do you think about a way that was going to mesh with everything? How do you think it seems like there's a lot of elements. I unfortunately haven't had a chance to attend, and just, I think, want to understand how you thought about kind of putting all those puzzle pieces together.
Yeah, I had already been kind of interested in virtual reality and done another food and VR project for this hotel chain in Nicaragua. We don't need to talk about it. It wasn't particularly exciting, but I think I was just learning how the platform worked. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really liked about VR, like right off the bat, is besides that it's immersive and people call it the empathy machine because you really do feel like you're, you know, there. If you've ever seen those funny videos of people who are in VR, it looks like they're standing on the edge of a building, but really they're literally like standing on a beam that's like 2 inches off the floor, and they'll be like screaming because they're so afraid. It's like, because things in VR do feel very real, so that's a big bonus. But one of the things that I thought was really cool was I feel it really levels out the playing field for extroverts and introverts when they're in a, you know, a close space together. One of the problems we would consistently see at our dinners is that, especially over the course of like 2.5 to 3 hours of dining, as an introvert myself, you just get kind of tired. Like, you're literally physically a little tired of even drinking and eating, but also, you know, you're mentally kind of fatigued, especially if the conversation has been going well. You might be feeling energized, but you're also, you know, just starting to get a little tired. And you'll start seeing the extroverts start like dominating the conversation. You can see it in their body language. You don't even have to, they could be silent, like you can mute them, but you can tell what's going on at the table. And as an introvert myself, I was always thinking about like, how could I make that dynamic better? I just didn't know. And when I started using VR, it just seemed like, oh, there's something here. I didn't really know how to tap into it, but there's something here. It's cool that with VR, you can be right next to someone, but feel like you're literally on a beach or on an island, very far away from them. And then you could come back and be in that space with them again. You know, it kind of gives introverts this sense of like freedom, sense of space, a sense of self in the midst of what can be a very chaotic or stressful public environment. And for extroverts, I mean, they're having a good time anyway. So for them, it's like they also get to interact with the art in their own way. But I think it was more for the introvert side, it kind of balanced out the energies at the table. And what we would notice is after people came out of the VR, then they would jump into conversation with a lot more vigor because literally they just needed a 2-minute break from each other.
Oh, that's so interesting. That was not the answer that I was expecting. So that's really, I'm glad I asked that to get that insight. You know, speaking of, you know, reactions and how people interact, what sort of reactions have you gotten from Asian in America? And was the type of reactions you were expecting? Have you used any of that to iterate on it?
Yeah,
I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the people who self-select to come into Asian America obviously are a niche group of people. So for all of our dinner guests have had very positive reactions, whether it's they're Asian American, I felt very affirming, helped them, you know, be able to talk about some of their own experiences, get to know each other at the table more deeply, for allies, just kind of understanding terms that they might not have ever heard before. So many people don't even know what the model minority is because they're not Asian, so it doesn't really apply to them. So for the most part, we've heard really positive things for the dinners. However, we've also taken Asian America to more public settings where, for example, we did one at something called Photoville, which is kind of this like art exhibition in New York, and it's open to the public, totally free. And it takes place on a couple weekends during the summertime, I think, spring, summertime. And because it was, you know, nobody had any contacts on what we were doing, we just had a booth there where people could watch some of the videos and look at photos, and we had one sample of things to eat. There were some people who were just not, I think they felt very uncomfortable and they were challenged, and they realized that they probably had done things or said things that were probably pretty racist in the past because we're all not perfect. We do bad things. And it really confronted them with probably feelings of, you know, insecurity or discomfort. And they said some pretty nasty things, or not, I wouldn't say like overtly nasty, just like kind of underhanded, like, oh, I don't get it. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't seem necessary, et cetera, et cetera. So it has been definitely an interesting exercise in watching how people deal with discomfort. Even people who do come to the dinners and have a positive reaction, you can see them grappling with the discomfort. And many times the reason they have a positive interaction is because the other people at the table are welcoming, help, you know, give them positive feedback, are open, make them feel safe. Like without those structures in place, when people feel uncomfortable, they often, more often than not, lash out. So anyway, interesting psychological lesson for me. And in terms of iterating on it, we've noticed at the beginning when we prime people less, you know, we still had the topics and we had everyone read and et cetera, but we didn't send multiple pre-event emails with lists of questions. We didn't send reading material beforehand. Not that it's not making it sound like it's a class or something, but I promise it's fun. I think because we didn't do that, sometimes people would just talk about random stuff. And then they would just, the point of the dinner was kind of point, you know, it was gone for them. And so we began really focusing in on making sure that we were sending the right questions in advance when I gave introductions at the beginning, really getting into the fact that this is not supposed to be just a fun dinner. This is educational, and also food is inherently political, and we want them to think about that tonight. So I think it's, you have to, you know, put yourself out there and set an example for other people to follow.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think one other thing you brought up was the sense of helping or getting people to think about, you know, belongingness and where they most belong. And you said, you know, some of those themes resonate with you. And I just kind of wanted to ask you, you know, where do you feel like you most belong?
That's a tough question. I grapple with that a lot because I often feel like I don't belong anywhere, especially being in part of an industry that, as much as I think there's a lot of exciting people who are doing interesting new things, for the most part is a pretty old, stodgy, male-dominated industry. If you just look at food media, who's on top? If you look at restaurants and who's on top, you can look at almost the restaurant coalition that like the White House built, and it's like all chains and like old white men, right? It's literally all men. So there's that, you know, feeling like there's not quite a sense of belonging because I'm young, I'm Asian, and I'm female. But then there's also, because my business doesn't quite operate neatly in one space, we're not exactly a restaurant. We are a nonprofit, but we're not a charity. You know, we're not really a pop-up. We also do content. Like, we're not a VR studio because we're not developers. Because we don't fit neatly anywhere, many times it is hard to find, you know, the right people to connect with or the right people to just have a support network with. That's something that I still often struggle with. I also recently moved to Los Angeles from New York to try and expand our geographical presence, and just finding a new group of people that I think female founders who are into what I'm trying to do. Because again, we're a nonprofit, so we're not raising any funding. A lot of times, female founders like are bonding, or the fact that they can't raise capital, which I can't raise capital too, but that's a different, like different kind of capital. Right. I think it's been an ongoing journey for me, is like finding where I belong. And like the Asian American community, especially in LA, is also has its own little identities. And then Asian American is very different from, you know, Asian from Asia. So yeah, it's always just like trying to find what little intersection I happen to sit at well, has been a challenge.
That's really helpful. And I think, you know, it's something that so many people grapple with, and to be able to also express some of those elements through a way that you are really good at expressing yourself is really, it's really interesting. So kind of, you know, we're recording this, of course, mid-coronavirus, mid-quarantine. Yeah. You know, curious how your business has shifted. What are you working on right now? Is this giving you more time to reflect and think about upcoming projects? Have you shifted the way that you help people engage through food and drink, given that there's so many societal and behavioral norms that are kind of changed, altered at the moment?
Yeah, it's been, well, we've definitely been impacted a lot by COVID. Obviously, in-person events are halted, so we had a lot of things lined up that are no longer happening, and we're not really sure when will happen again. I think the hardest thing was that we had just launched this community initiative called Experimental Salons, where we bring industry professionals together to talk about like one specific thing in their industry, and then we develop like resources and toolkits for everyone to have take action for that. So the last event that we did in February, the end of February, was with a bunch of food media professionals, and we had the question, how can food media better represent non-white cultures without tokenizing them? And we had this like amazing 2-hour facilitated conversation, and then people stayed for like another 3 hours to talk. So it was just like really, it was clear that we had found something that we wanted to pursue, and it was really, and we had another one lined up for New York and SF, and we were like really heartbroken when that's just not happening. And there is something about having a really small, intimate conversation like that in person versus having it on Zoom, which we're now kind of like trying to figure out if we can or cannot do. So we took some time. I unfortunately had to furlough my staff, and I think we were all just a little depressed for a few weeks and trying to find out our place in the world, how to keep going. Also, there was a lot of stress in that time of trying to find funding, and we don't need to get into how the government totally botched that. But I think the dust settled, the main thing is like, we still want to do something to give back to our community, because we're not a fully functional like restaurant. We don't have a space. We can't like produce tons of food and give it, even though I would love to. But, you know, me producing 5 things in my kitchen is not really as useful as what some of my colleagues are doing. So we were thinking about how can we communicate our service in a different way. What are we good at? And one of the things that I think my team is really awesome at is being able to synthesize difficult information and package them into resources and toolkits, as we were already doing for these salons. So we started this series called Community Skill Shares, where we have some experts in our community just come and volunteer their time, share their skills with other people, and we use it as a way to also raise money for their charity of choice as like a thank you for them spending the time and energy to do so. So we started with finances. We had my husband, who's our acting CFO, talk about personal finances as well as financial planning for small businesses. We had a seamstress do a mask making class, and then we just started a month-long series about mental health. So we have 2 therapists that we're working with out of Chicago, and we just covered like emotional responses to COVID-19, whether you're feeling like angry or guilty or having trouble sleeping or really, really anxious, as well as like managing identity loss. And next week's session is about healthy coping mechanisms, and then we're doing one about navigating relationships, and then we have a civic engagement season with a hospitality activist that I'm a big fan of. She'll be talking about how to like get engaged locally, how to actually get laws passed. How does our government even work? Because most people are honestly, like myself included, I have no idea how the government works. Like who do we vote? Like where do we find information about stuff? So that's exciting. I'm hoping to get this one person that I know on board about doing a class about how to convert higher sales into your online platform right now, because that's pretty pertinent. So that's like mainly what we've been doing, just trying to find experts that would be useful to everyone, provide these resources for free while hopefully raising a little bit of money for their charities. And then we're just working to put together, I mean, we're learning as well, putting together these really long resources documents that they can reference later.
I think that's so great. And it, you know, there's so many different ways that people are pivoting amid COVID, and, you know, just was wanting to understand a bit more about what you're doing in this time, because it seems like so much of your work and your career is really based on these face-to-face interactions. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how do you continue to get people to engage with food and drink and in potentially constrained situations. So
yeah, I mean, I've been like asked to do a couple of cooking classes and the like, because I had speaking engagements lined up before COVID hit, and I've done a couple of them so far. I just think, yeah, it's fine for now. It just is not the same. Like it really, it's never going to be the same, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fair. And I think it's something that we're all grappling with. Thankfully podcasts are pretty easy to do remote, but it is always in person. So I think, you know, one thing I always like to ask of every guest that comes on the show is, you know, advice that kind of sticks with you, and the way I quantify that almost is, you know, what's a piece of advice that someone's given you in the past that you've found yourself giving to others recently, and just kind of learning more about what that advice was.
Yeah, I always give the same. Well, I have like 2 pieces of advice that kind of came from the same person. One was from a friend who's also he's a restaurateur and also has like some chains of coffee shops, I think. Anyway, I just remember talking to him at the time, and we were debating if we wanted to have a restaurant because we had been approached about maybe having a brick and mortar place. And he was just saying, like, I was like, oh, I don't know. And he was like, there's just no good time to do it. there's never going to be a good time. There's not going to be a day where it's Saturday and you're going to be like, yeah, let me upend my lifestyle, take the plunge into something I don't know that I may totally fail at and feel really good about myself. Like that's never going to be a thing. So you just have to decide you're going to do it or not. And I think that gave me a lot of comfort because I had been waiting for like some sign, you know, that I should. But honestly, there was no sign. It was just, do I want to do it? If so, I should do it. Or I don't want to do it and I should do something else. And kind of related with that is just listening to other people doesn't really help that much in the long term in terms of them telling you if you should or should not do whatever you're grappling with. Because at the end of the day, only you know how that's going to make you feel. Him, and obviously because he owns restaurants, he's like, I think you should do it. Restaurants are great. But I knew in my heart that restaurants were not what I wanted, at least at that point in my life. And I'm really glad that we didn't pursue it, because God knows what I would be doing right now if that had been the case. So yeah. I think just at the end of the day, don't really listen to other people, because their opinions are totally valid and they're useful. And obviously you sought them for a reason, but they're still just opinions.
Right. But you know, like I think this is interesting, this point that you bring up. It's, you know, but how do you understand and know which feedback or opinions to take and which feedback and opinions not dismiss, mm-hmm. but maybe not address, so to say?
Yeah, I mean, that one's tough, especially because I remember this case where I was really excited. I was presenting this idea that I had to, I wouldn't say a close friend, but someone I really respected, mm-hmm. another woman in the industry, and she just hated it. And I was so shocked. I was really hurt. And I think big part of it, I was kind of hurt because I don't think she quite listened to me. She just thought, she like assumed what she saw, and she didn't. Like, I was trying to explain to her more details and she wasn't really listening. And I remember thinking like, oh, maybe this idea is like a terrible idea. I shouldn't do it at all. And that idea has slowly morphed and changed into the studio. But at the time, I remember feeling both resentful and angry with her, and then confused about like what I should do with my life. And I think it's like you have this guttural reaction that like if someone tells you something that isn't what you, it's not so much that you don't want to hear it, it's just, it's not the path that you want to take for yourself, then just ignore it. You know, like her feedback was still valid. Clearly I didn't have my elevator pitch down because she didn't understand what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. but I still wanted like me pursuing whatever idea she had was definitely not what I wanted to do. I knew that my idea was the right path. I just had to finesse it more. So I don't know if that totally answers the question. I think it's like finding like the pieces that actually make sense, but still pursue like with their feedback, even if it's not the feedback you were hoping to hear, but still pursuing your gut feeling of what the right decision is.
Yeah. It's almost like understanding what your values, your essence are, and really finding things that kind of align and enhance that. At least that's what I'm getting from you. From the story that you're telling. So
yeah
I think that's fair. You know, one more thing, I think just kind of to help listeners, you know, as you say, kind of hack their way to success or just understand, you know, how people really come into their own and find careers and do things that really resonate with them and they're successful at, is, you know, is there a thing that you can point to resource-wise and mindset-wise that you think has really been crucial in the success that you've found professionally?
I think the biggest thing that I feel proud of having done for myself is every time I saw an opportunity, I kind of went for it and overrode, I would say like 80% of the opportunities that I would apply for, I just felt completely not qualified to do, but I just went and applied for it anyway. And I really encourage everyone to do that, because most of the time, I was qualified. I still had to learn a couple of things, but I was qualified fundamentally to do it. And anything that I didn't really know, I learned quickly. And I think to myself, there are so many clients that I have now that I've had for a couple of years, or, you know, books that I've been able to work on and write it just started with me responding back to a Twitter thread, you know, saying, hey, I'm interested in writing this. I have no experience, but I want to do it. Here's some other credentials that I have. And, you know, not everyone's going to say yes. I've been told no so many times, but the few people that do, like, I worked literally, that was how I started with the first book that I wrote. That publisher ended up doing two books with me, and then I just finished another book for another publisher because of the first two books, which, again, I was not qualified to write to start with, or I didn't feel qualified to write, but I was qualified to write. So, yeah, just like going ahead and just at least trying to get the opportunity, because why not?
Yeah, I love that. I also think that's such a great note to end on. I've been really impressed about the way that you talk about your work and just the steadfastness, I think, in understanding yourself. And I feel like that's been really key for you in the success that you've found in your career. And just kind of hearing everything about the work that you're doing, I'm excited to continue to follow all the work that Studio Tao is doing. And yeah, just thank you so much for the time.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited to be able to share on here. So thank you for having me.
Want more Ta for Ta? Hit subscribe to get updates on our episodes. You can also hit us up on Twitter at Ta for Ta. And we love messages and engaging with you all over email at ta.for.ta.china@gmail.com. Ta for Ta, Women's Success China, is a proud member of the Seneca Network. Many thanks to the entire team, including Kaiser Kuo, Jason McRonald, and Jamie Wei. Don't forget to fill out the survey. We really want to hear from you, and you can find that in the show description. Until next time, I'm Juliana Batista, and this is Ta for Ta.